till I'm charged. Writing in my book of rhymes, all the words past the margin. The whole of mic a throbbing, mechanical movement, understandable smoothness that murderers move with. The thief sting, play me at night, they won't act right. A fiend of hip hop, it's got me stuck like a crack pipe. Command activation, react like I'm facing time like Pappy Mason. With pins I'm embracing, wipe the sweat off my dome, spit the phlegm on the street. And the Nikes on my feet, keep my cipher complete. Weather cruising in the six cab, a Montero Jeep, I can't call it. Beats make me falling asleep, I keep falling. Never falling 6 feet deep, I'm out for presidents to represent me. I'm out for presidents to represent me. I'm out for dead presidents to represent me.
Welcome one, welcome all. This is the Next Step Radio Show. I am your host, Jacob Appleman. The website where this podcast originates from, gofindtheothers.com. That is gofindtheothers.com. And the email address, if you'd like to get a hold of me, thenextstepradioshow@gmail.com. That is thenextstepradioshow@gmail.com. At Go Find the Others, you can find the link to my Twitter and Facebook. Can also be reached there. Find me, tweet me, friend me, poke me. It's up to you. We have a very special guest today, returning from season one of the Next Step Radio Show. His name is Nathan Frazier. Wanted to kick off the new season of the Next Step Radio Show with this topic that I think is the utmost of importance. As we truthers, or whatever you want to call us, move forward, all of the nefarious underpinnings and power brokers have been exposed. Learning more names and more rituals may or may not help us through this. And then when it comes to the solutions category, which is our main focus here, it can get a little difficult, sometimes squirrely, and lead to arguments. But what I found, changing one's mindset tends to be the most beneficial approach, because so many of these things are or aren't related, may or may not be fixable. And attacking, devising a plan of attack, and or fighting against these things, is completely pointless. But if you operate your daily life with certain principles, certain values, a certain frame of mind, some of these other problems come into focus a bit more easily. Speaking of Facebook, just a few days ago, I had an interesting exchange with fellow researchers, brilliant people, but it was, believe it or not, discussing gay marriage. And that's not the topic I want to present, but I always find it odd how people want to beg the state for permission to do this, or to deny this group permission to do that. Gay marriage being the example, I was simply pointing out the fact that asking, the state for permission to do anything is the problem in and of itself, because that's a mindset. That's the way you conduct yourself, whether it's gay marriage, whether it's tax issues, whether it's a conscientious objecting against illegal and immoral wars. There are nonviolent, peaceful approaches to solutions that I feel would do the greatest service in a quest for a more freer society. But people with the paradigm of the state being the ultimate power tend to get intimidated or backed into a corner, or they won't even consider non-compliance in relationship to solutions to various issues, because they still have this thing in the back of their head where the state is correct and this violent form of government, as long as we have some say in it, is the best we can do. And even though we don't like what it's doing now, maybe we should just get different people in there. Maybe these current people could have different approaches. Maybe if we screamed loud enough. Maybe if we gathered enough people. Maybe if we got in their faces. These people will do, you know, the right thing. Or deny people from doing what we think is wrong. And those people can be correct in their wishes and desires and outlook on the outcome of the issue, but their approach still includes the state. And that's, this one is really hard. You know, you can, 9/11 was an inside out job. People get it. These wars are fake. People get it. You know, problem, reaction, solution. People get it. The vaccines are poison. GMO food's not good for you. People understand these things. But this paradigm here of the state versus no state, whether it's anarchy or volunteerism or agorism, there's different approaches, Thoreauvian self-sufficiency. You know, I don't think the name is that important, but the mindset is. I think if what ties the war, the anti-war crowd, the 9/11 truth crowd, the tax resistor crowd, what all of these things have in common is the state authority to tell you, you have to go to war, you have to pay taxes, you have to vote this, you have to do what, you know, we voted on, you have to follow these rules we passed, healthcare, the NDAA, all this nonsense. These aren't separate issues because the commonality that links them all is the state. And I think a proper perspective on what the state is and what the state isn't will help us approach all of these other topics in the solutions arena. Since the Next Step radio show is about taking the next step, we want to take all of those who are awake and get them out of bed doing something. I think this topic is why I started off this second season and the first episode here with Nathan Frazier from livefree.fm. I will link all of his previous works, interviews, radio shows. He's actually written a book, which if you're not familiar with sovereignty and or the no state concept, he has it for free available at his website for beginners and or people who are new to the subject. Maybe you have a neighbor that doesn't listen to iPod players and MP3s. Download this book, print it off. It's fantastic for maybe switching mindset, shattering this state ultimate power paradigm. It's very good for an introduction into a sovereign mindset. Nathan Frazier has also been a recording artist. Like I said, a radio show talk host. However in the world you want to say it. Doesn't bother me. I can't even say it. So we'll get into who he is. If you didn't hear any of our previous episodes, we're going to talk about the evil A word, anarchy, and the whole bit. I like to think of Nathan as a brilliant mind and a philosopher, and he has extended that into writing, whether it's text, music, hip-hop, art, sharing ideas with others. Fascinating individual, and this conversation is to ease you into the mindset of what the state is so we can move through our own individual issues with separate topics with a clearer picture of what we're actually going up against and what we're actually not going up against. So, without any further ado, we're going to ado just a bit. This week's sponsor. I've got a new approach I've taken, and I've always had it for myself, But instead of drumming up advertising for bandwidth and things and new equipment, what I do is I find people who freely share ideas, art, podcasts, talk shows, videos, whatever it is that entertains, enlightens, and educates me. I look for serious people on serious topics, offering serious solutions. And the ones who give it away free because that is what they feel their calling is, I always give back in some form or fashion, whether it's a monetary donation, a purchase of a product that they would give away freely anyway. However you see fit, there's places that do things like wish lists where there's certain items they need for their continuing of their work that you can be purchased for them. Instead of drumming up BS commercials and advertising for companies or products that may or may not be on par with a better world, what I do and I suggest other people do is go find the others. Are they making the world a better place? Or is this product, idea, art, media, whatever it is it changing your world for the better? Drop them a few bones of any kind. Just some quick round math. $5 isn't a whole lot to spend. And giving someone a dollar sometimes could be more insulting than gracious. But if you made a consistent effort, like I do, to give several people small amounts of money every month, if 10 million people, and I think that's a easy number to throw out for things like the Truth Movement or whatever the hell this is, if 10 million people just gave $5 a month and spread it around, that's $50 million a month that the Truther community would have access to for things like better media, better promotions, quicker turnaround, more content, conventions. I've been saying this forever. How many UFO conventions are there all over the country every year on Roswell still? And that was in 1947. What if we started having free energy conferences like that? Instead of trying to get an electromagnetic generator on the shelf at Walmart, what if we just figured out how to make them and started teaching each other in conferences? And an electromagnetic generator is just one small example. There are frequency healing machines. There are alternative herbal medicines. There are super nutrient-dense foods, things like nootropics. There are so many ways we can help and heal and move forward and progress without a top-down pyramidal structure that it's up to us. Walmart's never going to bring you free energy. You're going to have to figure it out for yourself. And if it's not making something of your own, go find the others who are and throw them a few bucks, a few promotions. A big fat thank you email will inspire and motivate those who are doing things for the right reasons just as well as a dollar bill would. So if those of us who care to make a difference actually made a difference, and instead of that extra drink at the bar or that professional football game, take a few bucks on a consistent basis and spread it around for those who are trying to make a difference, and let's get this thing turned around. It's up to us now. It's not going to be done for us. And so instead of sponsorships and begging, go find people who deserve it. Spread that love around. Now, the ado's are over. All the links to Nathan's work will be found under or around this post. If you found this interview somewhere else besides gofindtheothers.com, head over there. This is the Next Step Radio Show, episode something or other. This was actually recorded on May 9th of 2012. The beginning is near, by the way. And it will be posted on Wednesday, May 16th, 2012. Ladies and gentlemen, Nathan Frazier.
My name's Nathan Frazier. I've been a researcher for the last, 11, 12 years. Ever since 9/11, I really started, I started looking into things. Before that, I was a rapper and graffiti artist. And so, I guess to go back even further before that, I grew up in a pretty poor family. We grew up in Los Angeles, and my family is pretty much predominantly Mexican. And so growing up in Los Angeles and coming from minority neighborhoods, you see a lot of government corruption, a lot of police corruption. So I kind of always had a healthy distrust of government. Then I guess as life goes on, watching things like Waco, Texas happen, and eventually 9/11. When 9/11 happened, that was like one of the catalyst points in my life where I decided to start looking for solutions, because it started seeming like this thing that we call government was just getting more and more out of control. And when 9/11 happened, and it was quickly followed with the Patriot Act, and it was around the same time that we started seeing cameras go up everywhere, and we started seeing less and less privacy with our banking, and more intrusion into everyday life, and it started really looking like America was about to take a turn towards, like, basically Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia. It looked like we were on the breaking point where we were about to lean over into that type of society. And up until that point, I was a hip hop kid. I loved gangster rap. I made gangster rap. I did a lot of the self-destructive activities that are heavily promoted in that type of culture. And I had that F the police type attitude. So that wasn't that much of a change. But when 9/11 happened and we started seeing all these political changes happen, myself and my little brother, who actually just passed away last month, he's no longer with me, but me and him started changing the music that we were making to more of a political type of politically active type of music. And so I adopted the name Paranoid, because for years I had already been called it and it fit the type of music that I was doing. So I just adopted the stage name Paranoid. And so a lot of listeners or a lot of the fans know me as Paranoid. But recently, well, we'll get into the name change, I guess, in a second. But I started making music that was more predominantly politically affiliated and had very strong theme of revolution and even violent revolution, which I'm not so much for anymore, and I'll explain that as well. But from there, I got a little gig on a radio show called Ghosts of the Republic Radio with my homeboy Ghost Dog, and this was, 6 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. It was a while ago. And he wanted to have a political musician come on and help him co-host a show where we would interview other political musicians. And so, as fate would have it, I was the one who got chosen to be the co-host. That got me into radio. And from 2002 until about 2006, 2007, somewhere around there, I spent a lot of time researching the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Vatican, the English nobility, the Freemasons, all of these different groups, the Vril, the Reptilians, all of this stuff, the Zionists. I dug down every single rabbit hole I could find. Now, when I look back at a lot of it, I think probably a lot of it was wasted time. But still part of my growing and learning experience, and doing the radio show and doing so many interviews, I realized that there's a lot of people out there complaining. There's a lot of people out there whining and moaning and pointing out the problems of the world, but there's not very many people that are offering solutions. So everybody's running around crying about how it's going to rain, but nobody's grabbing umbrellas and handing out umbrellas. And I realized that, I guess, either it was my responsibility to society or just my responsibility to myself, but I needed to start looking for umbrellas. And since, like I said, I'd grown up in Los Angeles and I had seen the corruptive nature of the judicial system, and even after I moved back to Colorado from the West Coast back to Colorado, a lot of my friends have been imprisoned for victimless crimes. A lot of them have been completely screwed over by the judicial system out here as well. And so I realized that this is something that's a nationwide phenomenon, where this judicial system is just punking and bullying and robbing and kidnapping and holding people for ransom. And so I started trying to find ways to fight back against it. And I figured that probably one of the best ways to actually start offering solutions is to attack the system that almost everybody deals with, and that is the court system. A lot of people have kids, and so they understand how corrupt the school is, but a lot of people don't have kids, so they never really have to deal with the school system. Or there's other situations as well where, you know, there's certain problems that only a small percentage of us have to deal with. The court system is something that almost everybody has to deal with. Almost everybody gets pulled over. Almost everybody has to go and pay outrageous fines for doing things that didn't hurt anybody. And I kind of started looking into the whole sovereignty movement and commercial redemption and all of that stuff. And again, I wasted a lot of time and a lot of energy researching things that really had no credibility. But eventually I did start having success, and I did start finding solutions to a lot of the legal problems. And in doing so, it really opened my eyes to, I guess, the whole reality of what this thing called government or this thing called the state really is. And from there, studying the philosophy of what this thing that we call government is, and studying the philosophy of what a free individual is supposed to be, from there I've kind of transitioned, I guess, or moved further down the road into the philosophy or the idealism of anarchy or voluntarism or voluntarism. And so that's kind of where I'm at right now. The reason I changed the name from Paranoid back to my given name is just because I've been doing a radio show called Live Free FM for a while now, and I've been getting bombarded with people needing help, and I'm helping as many people as I can. But when I extend a hand out to help people, it's a lot easier just to give them my email or my cell phone number and tell them to ask for Nathan than it is to have them ask for Paranoid, because a lot of people are not quick to call somebody named Paranoid and ask them for legal help. I figure if they know me by my given name, it'll lend a little bit of credibility to the show. It lends a little bit of credibility to myself, but it also makes them a little less apprehensive to reach out. And I don't want to be shooting myself in the foot when my goal is to help people that need help. I don't want to be putting up that extra barrier of having a pseudonym. And it's hard to trust people in this environment of legal research and conspiracy theory research. And when somebody, you only know them by a moniker or a nom de guerre or a nickname, it makes it a lot harder for you to give them the benefit of the doubt that you should actually give that person your trust. So for the sake of people that I want to help, I started going by Nathan. And to the listeners of your show, the last couple of interviews that I did with you, I went under the name Paranoid, but it's still me, same guy, just a different reference, and that's about it.
No, I feel you on the nickname. A lot of people know my online presence as Man Apples, which is just my last name switched. It has nothing to do with testicles, although it's kind of funny. But yeah, it is easier to deal with people saying, "Hey, this is Jacob," instead of "Hey, this is Man Apples," so they don't get weird immediately. And just to tie in a quick point between the government and the what it is or isn't, what the state is or isn't. In our first couple talks, we hit the high points of the no state ideology, which is essentially, it's kind of like one of those 3D books. It takes a really hard, long stare to see the picture in that jumbled mess of pattern. But once you get it, it's like, oh, wow, you know, it is there. That was easy. There's so much information, disinformation, and propaganda, you know, about how things should be or shouldn't be, that the truth of the actual matter is very simple. And you know, there is no such thing as, you know, America. There is no such thing as the state of Colorado. There is no such thing. You know, these are paperwork entities like Microsoft or Walmart. You know, there actually isn't a state. It's things we build up in our head. And once you grip it, it's real easy to see. But for a lot of people, that it's almost impossible for them to, you know, sit cross-eyed for 30 minutes and really reflect on it. But you had made a point in my listening to your radio show since that had never occurred to me, and that a lot of researchers or truth movement types are familiar with the Hegelian dialectic, the problem, reaction, solution, or well, what else do they call it? Synthesis, antithesis, and whatever. But the Hegelian dialectic, a lot of people think it's for things like the Patriot Act and 9/11, or, you know, these big super uber events where they're trying to provoke a reaction out of the people by staging the problem and having the solution ready in their back pocket. But that's essentially how court works also. Traffic court, all the way up to, you know, federal bad boy court, the prosecution and the solution, the judge, the problem and the solution are on the same team. And a lot of these charges, especially in the nonviolent crime category, are to get you to provoke your defense or your reaction. So it's the Hegelian dialectic practiced by these black robe magi right in front of us every day on things like traffic tickets, where nobody is harmed. And even if you could make the case that unsafe driving does harm people, then how is the solution paying this fictitious entity $120 going to solve anything? So it's one of those things. Your work and your philosophy really broke me out of that mindset also of how we can fight this beast. And seeing it for what it really is has got to be the first step, you know, before solutions can even be approached. And your work is testament to the fact that once you realize the state of California doesn't exist and red light cameras are not a crime, running through a red light camera is not a crime against property or person, then the way you approach it after that, in this Hegelian dialectic of problem, reaction, solution, is pretty essential. And without repeating the last shows, basically, let's just do a thumbnail real quick of how the no state philosophy would approach solution-oriented things in a courtroom.
Well, first of all, I have to give credit where credit is due, and that would be to Mark Stevens. I met him about 2 years ago, and this was after I had been studying different legal remedies for about two and a half years, and was not having any or very, very minimal success in the courtroom. And I was taking it from the approach that the entire system was legitimate, and I just wanted it to legitimately respect me as a sovereign human being, as somebody who was on equal ground with the legal system or the legal state or the republic or the democracy or whatever you want to call it. And after meeting Mark Stevens and learning from him, and this was probably like one of the most fortunate things. I have to honestly give thanks to whatever it is, whatever creative force that inspires things to happen in the universe, has definitely laid certain events in my life to lead me to where I am now. And I got a call about 2 years ago from a guy named Eddie Mock out in Salt Lake City, or Sandy, Utah. And he said that they were doing a little political convention and he wanted me to come out to it. And so they paid for me to come out and do a little bit of a speech and a little bit of a musical performance. But when I got out there, I got to the airport, and the only person that I knew that was on the roster that I had ever heard of was Mark Stevens. And I had just started reading his book, and I really wasn't very familiar with his approach yet. But I got off of the airplane. I went to go to the car to get my ride to where I was going to be staying at. And the guy that picked me up said, "Hey, we got to hold on a second. We got somebody else coming in that we got to give a ride." I was like, "Okay." And we waited for a little bit, and the guy touched down and came to meet us at the car. And as luck would have it, it was Mark. And so I got to meet Mark Stevens personally, and I got to do a little mini interview with him. I got to interrogate him, basically, the whole car ride from the airport to the convention hall. And then I got to spend a lot of the weekend with him just conversing and learning and absorbing as much as I could from him. And basically his approach, and it's the approach that makes the most sense to me, is that instead of begging for this system to respect you as an equal, or begging for this system to respect you as a sovereign, the answer is really just simply to recognize the system for what it really is, and recognize their authority for what it really is, and that's fraudulent. And instead of begging your slave masters to recognize that you're not a slave, the real solution is to realize that you have no slave masters, that these people who have convinced you that they are your slave masters are really just human beings, and they're criminals. And for you to have to go beg criminals to be respected as a sovereign will never actually work. What you have to really realize is that that you don't need their permission to be sovereign. They don't even have the authority to recognize your sovereignty. And once you get that through your head, and you realize that that's the facts of the universe, that's the facts of reality, then you just base your approach off of that understanding. And instead of going in there and trying to call them out on it and make points and shove your point of view down their throat, go in there understanding your point of view, understanding where it conflicts with their false point of view, and formulate your questions to expose the falsity or the falsehood nature of their point of view. And through your questions, you bring them over to your point of view. And that has been the most effective thing that I have learned. And if it wasn't for, I guess, just fate that me and him got off of two different airplanes at the same airport at the same time, I probably never would have came to the position that I'm at right now. So whatever it was that put me and him on the same path, it was a life-changing event for myself. So I am forever grateful for that.
Yeah, and it snowballed on, because I, you know, was on a similar, you know, quest as yourself, but headed down a different road. And if I hadn't heard you speak on another radio show, then that concept, you know, may or may not have come my way. So that's the cool thing about those circumstances, as neat as they are personally, you know, that they keep growing and growing, and like those freaking fractals, man, it's before you know it, it's spreading like wildfire. So the no state approach, basically, well, and I like to say this first too, that with great freedom comes great responsibility. And when you talk about no state topics with people who aren't, you know, well versed in much of it, you know, they automatically think that bad people are trying to get away with their crimes by implementing strategies like this. And I always tell people, first, if you're going to have a no state philosophy and approach, then you also need to conduct yourself responsibly. So whether or not drunk driving is a crime against person or property, drunk driving isn't a good idea for the sake of your fellow human beings. Altering your consciousness while you're behind the wheel of a vehicle isn't always the best idea. And if you're going to be dangerous, then, consequences will ensue. The best way to beat a drunk driving rap is to not drive drunk. But, that's the caveat I like to put on it is people think that, this is for criminals who like to wild out and then try and get away with their crimes by claiming, Colorado ain't got nothing on me, which they don't, but that doesn't mean you get to be an a-hole.
Yeah, and I guess from a legal standpoint, the easiest way to explain it is this. Pretty much it's a universally held concept or a universally held rule that people should not aggress against other people. People should not cause harm to other people. That's pretty much the basis of why people defend government. People defend government because they say, well, without government, who would stop the violent criminals who want to take my money and rape my daughter and burn my house down? So we need government, if not for anything else, for the one thing of protecting us from people who would aggress against us. So that right there is in perfect alignment with the way that I believe things too. I believe that people should adhere to, follow, and practice the non-aggression principle, which is basically it's not cool to aggress against people. The initiation of violence is never called for. It's never justified. Violence in self-defense, in my opinion, is totally justified. In other people's opinions, maybe not. They would say, it's better to turn the other cheek, or it's better to be a pacifist than it is to react to violence with violence. I say that depending on the circumstances, it can go either way. If somebody's going to try and kill me or kill one of my family members, they're probably going to end up dead. And I don't like I wouldn't even want to think about the fact of having to make that decision. But if it was something that serious, I would use violence or force to stop it. If somebody was breaking into my house and I could scare them off with a baseball bat, I probably wouldn't kill them. Or if I could tell them, hey, get out of here, I got a gun, and not have to actually pull the gun out, I would prefer that. So depending on the situation, violence as a response is questionable. But violence as the initiatory action is never cool. To initiate violence against somebody who hasn't done anything wrong to you is never cool. And most people would agree with that. And most people would say, well, that's why we need the state, is because there are a few people out there who don't agree with that. But then what they don't understand is that the state itself is the initiation of violence. Government itself is the initiation of violence against peaceful people. And all you have to do is look at what police officers do to peaceful protesters, and you can see that the state is the initiation of violence against peaceful people. All you have to do is look at taxation. And people who, like Ed and Elaine Brown, who protested their taxes, they were peaceful people. The state initiated force and violence against them. So a lot of people believe that we need the state in order to be protected from the initiation of violence, but they turn a blind eye to the fact that the state itself is the initiation of violence. So it's a double-bladed sword or double-edged sword that they think is there to protect them, but they don't realize that the blade is on the other side as well. And so my whole point of view about it is the whole thing's imaginary anyways. States don't exist. Nations don't exist. People exist. Territory exists. But the political philosophies that get attached to the people or the political philosophies that get attached to the territory are just figments of our imagination. And once you realize that all of this stuff that we live in fear of, all of these, you know, one world government or police states, all of these things only can exist by people holding on to a fantasy. Once you get to that point, you realize that the most effective way to battle this is to stop paying attention to the fantasy and to start waking up people to the reality. And instead of worrying about the fantasy, or instead of trying to incorporate yourself into the fantasy and change the fantasy from inside, or hoping and praying that somebody who's acting on behalf of the fantasy will tame the fantasy down a little bit or make the fantasy less threatening, you realize that all of that is still feeding the fantasy. The real solution, the only solution, is to move society to a point where it can exist without the fantasy. To move society to a point where they realize that in order to be protected from acts of aggression or from people initiating aggression, we need to move past the point of believing that we need this fanciful, imaginary entity known as the state that has the monopoly on aggressing against peaceful people.
And just as a slightly humorous tangent, Santa Claus, it's pretty similar to that when people really can't grip it. I mean, there's evidence for Santa everywhere, but, you know, most people would agree that he's not a real person. You know, there's the flag of Colorado or the flag of Missouri, you know, the United States flag. They have all these uniforms and office holders and politicians, but, you know, these aren't real places. You know, it's the Santa Claus syndrome. And have you ever wondered if, you know, things like Santa Claus are early training for this type of mentality to exist in grown adults who have the ability to discern fantasy from reality?
I don't know specifically if it's early training, but it definitely takes advantage of the same mindset. And if you look at Santa Claus is an imaginary tool that's reinforced everywhere, from Coke commercials to Miracle on 34th Street to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The idea of Santa Claus is reinforced everywhere. And the reason that it's reinforced everywhere is so that people who are a little bit more intelligent, i.e. parents, have an imaginary thing in order to keep the less intelligent people, i.e. children, under control and well-behaved. They use this fantasy to keep their children well-behaved. They say, oh, you better be good or Santa Claus isn't going to bring you this, or Santa Claus is watching. He knows that you're doing this and this and this, and you know, and they even tell you to make wish lists to Santa. You write down what you want Santa to do for you at Christmas. The state is the same thing. There's people who are slightly more intelligent than the rest of us, i.e. Politicians, and they use this mythological thing called the state that doesn't actually exist, and they tell us that it will either punish us or reward us based on our behavior. And we are like the children, we're the less intelligent people that believe in this thing that doesn't exist, that constantly gets reinforced through television, through school, through what our parents tell us. And when you suggest that society could exist without the state, when you say, hey, human beings could organize and be prosperous without having government, it's just like telling somebody, you know, a child who is fully embraced the idea of Santa Claus. It's like telling them, hey, you can accept that Santa Claus doesn't really exist and you can live your life without Santa Claus existing and you can still get presents. You can still give presents. To tell people that society can exist without the state is almost the equivalent of telling a child, you can still exchange gifts on Christmas without believing in Santa Claus. And a child who wasn't willing to accept that idea will reject it automatically and think and look at you as if you're some sort of blasphemous fool. And that's typically the same response when you get that you get when you tell people, hey, I think that society could exist without government and we would be more prosperous. But, I mean, what's really crazy about it is when I first started trying to promote this ideology of having a society that doesn't have at its core an abusive, coercive government, people looked at me and ridiculed me and laughed at me and told me I was insane, that it would never work. But over the last year or two, the idea seems to be catching on like wildfire, and we see all kinds of agorist action taking place. We see all kinds of – I mean, to be honest, when I first started fighting people's court cases and actually winning them, I hardly ever had anybody that had the fortitude to stand up and fight their cases. Now I have 6-7 people a week almost come to me and be like, okay, I got this ticket. Tell me how to fight it. I'm willing to go and fight it. And I wake them up, first of all, to the idea that the ticket isn't valid, that the state has no authority over you. And more and more people are receptive of the idea. More and more people do not just outright reject the idea. And I don't think it's because I've become a better salesman for the idea. I think it's just that for some reason or another, the idea has finally, you know, it's like that saying, nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. I feel like anarchy or volunteerism or the non-aggression principle and having a society based off of the non-aggression principle, I think that it's just an idea whose time has come, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah, we're getting closer to that 100th monkey. I have 4 children from the ages 12 down to 4, and ever since our oldest daughter, her first Christmas, she didn't even know English yet, and I told her that Mommy and I are Santa Claus. And that's, you know, we homeschool, we're vegetarian for the most part, haven't been to McDonald's in 20 years. A lot of that stuff really weirds people out. But you tell somebody else's kid when they're over at your house that, you know, there is no Santa Claus, and they'll about ready to fight you over it. It's interesting because they have similar responses to, anarchist type scenarios. And before we say that word too many more times, let's dispel and or shake off some of the negative attributes that have been affixed to the word anarchy, much like conspiracy theorist. Isn't anarchy a cuss word in most countries?
Well, I think that a majority of people, when they hear the word anarchy, the first thing that comes to their mind is a teenager with a brick in his hand or a Molotov cocktail and a corporation's window being busted in or somebody's home being burnt to the ground.
And black flags usually playing in the background.
Yeah, right. And that's so funny because that reminds me of how old I am. But realistically, all anarchy means is that no one man has the right to rule over another man. An means the opposite or the lacking of, and archy is some form of rulership. So anarchy just means that nobody has the right to rule over anybody else. Most people would agree to that statement. You ask them, does somebody have the right to, put it in a sense like slavery. Was slavery correct? Was slavery in alignment with reality? Does a white man really have the right to own a black man? Or, you take it back even further to like the Roman times. Does a Roman citizen have the right to own a citizen of a nation that Rome overtook? And looking at it now, knowing what we know, most people will say no. One man doesn't have the right to rule over another man just because of their skin color. And that's what anarchy is. Anarchy is that belief taken and applied to the state. because most people will say, no, you know, a man doesn't have the right to rule over another man unless he's wearing a black robe, or unless he is an elected representative, or unless he works for the IRS, or any of these other things. So the basic human rule that we all pretty much adhere and agree with, that one man doesn't have the right to use threats, violence, coercion, or force in order to rule and dominate over another man, we all pretty much agree with it. But then when you add in this thing called government, this imaginary thing that doesn't even actually exist, then people completely throw out that basic moral structure of saying that someone doesn't have the right to rule over. So anarchy is just taking basic common sense and basic common knowledge and applying it to this imaginary thing called government and saying, hey, if it's a universal rule that somebody doesn't have the right to use force, violence, threats, coercion in order to get their way, that should also apply to government. And most people just can't make that connection. But like I said, more and more people are starting to be able to make that connection. And hopefully through work that I'm doing, through work that a lot of other people are out there doing, hopefully this wildfire that seems to be catching will start spreading even more. And it's my hope that within my lifetime, we will start to see enough people realize the blatant absurdity of government and start to ignore it and throw it off, and we'll actually have some sort of change. Because historically, people have had revolution after revolution, and as soon as we throw off an oppressive government, our first instinctive, I don't even want to say instinctive, but our first step usually as a group is to start some new form of coercive and abusive government, and hopefully that won't continue to repeat itself in the future. And I never thought that would be a realistic hope, but more and more so, the more I see things spreading, the more I see the consciousness and the idea of peaceful, voluntary anarchy spreading, it seems like a more realistic goal for us to actually reach within my lifetime.
So how would we keep criminals in line if we didn't have a governor and a president?
Well, first of all, I'm going to attack a couple of things. First of all, right now, what we do with criminals is two different things. If you're somebody who likes to steal, or you're somebody who likes to use violence against other people, or you're somebody who likes to manipulate to get your own way, and you come from a poor family, we usually stick you in a prison. If you come from a rich family, though, and you have those same qualities, we usually stick you in the White House or in the House of Representatives. So right now, instead of being protected from the most vile people in society, we actually are ruled over by the most vile people in society. So right now, it's not working. Second, the solution that we use right now is prison. And prison does not work. Prison takes people, and usually when they come out of prison, they're worse than when they went in. Prison doesn't focus on rehabilitation. Prison doesn't focus on actually making society safe. And the way that prison is set up, much like all other industries, they want repeat customers. Prison needs people to keep coming back in order to stay prosperous, in order to stay profitable. So it's not, we think that prison is there to keep society safe, but when people come out of prison, they're usually worse than when they went in. You take somebody who gets caught stealing a car, or gets caught shoplifting, or gets caught with a pound of cocaine on them, or something like that. Somebody who's from, you know, our reality, and you stick them in a reality that's predominantly based off of racial hatred and racial discrimination and separation, and you stick them in a reality that's completely fear and violence based. You got to be constantly looking over your shoulder. You've got to, you know, you've got to learn to hate people based off of their skin color. You've got to learn how to be violent in order to survive. You take somebody who gets caught with a pound of marijuana and you stick them in that environment for 10 years. When they come out, they are much worse and society is much less safe for having that person gone through the prison system. But the prison system itself has a guaranteed customer who's going to come right back. So right now, our answer is prison, and that doesn't work. Most people will agree that prison systems, the way that they're set up now, do not make us safer. So, you know, whatever idea I could come up with or whatever idea a group of us could come up with, more than likely it'd be better than what the government gives us as an option. So I don't know how we would handle it. There's lots of different suggestions out there. We'd probably have to try a couple and see what happens. But I mean, the way that it's handled right now, most of the people in prison are nonviolent offenders. When they get out and they go back again, they're violent offenders. So the way we're handling it now is not worth continuing just because I don't have the answer for what might be a better way to handle it.
Exactly. And it's blatantly obvious if people just set aside their emotions and look at it objectively. I had the same joke about church. You know, people say, oh, you want a better world? Come to my church with me. And I say, how's that been working for the last 2,000 years?
Right. And that's, unfortunately, that's the mentality, is people, even though they know that what they're doing is not working, because they're so afraid to let go of the old and try something new, they'll just continue doing it over and over and over again.
Right. And I've heard you mention this on your show, I think it was 2 weeks ago. Another quip people hit you with when you speak of anarchistic anything is that, you know, how would we pay for the roads? And instead of trying to devise a scheme with which we could continue highway construction without the forceful collection of taxes, what if we figured out how to move from point A to point B without cars? So, you know, outside the box thinking, you know, comes into play also. It prison or no prison, it, you know, it may be C or, you know, D, both, and it's not going to necessarily come from, you know, the set of ideas we've tried. You know, like you said, the prisons aren't working, which doesn't mean you have the answer of what would work. But coming up with new ideas sure sounds like a lot more fun than bagging on Baron Rothschild for another year.
Yeah, and realistically, I mean, that's the whole thing is a lot of people say, well, without the state, how would we be able to do this particular thing, or how would we be able to provide this particular service? Number one, if the service is actually needed and actually valuable, people will pay for it. In Russia, at one point in time, government provided bread, and all, you know, there were no private bakeries. There was no supermarket where you could go get your bread from. The government provided the bread. But realistically, people provided the bread. People were there to make the bread, and people who were hungry were there to go get the bread. All the government did was add a whole layer or a whole level of bureaucracy between you and the baker. And to think that any problem that we might have, whether it be roads or prisons or anything, to think that any problem that we might have that we think without government we wouldn't be able to pay for it, or we wouldn't be able to afford it, or we wouldn't be able to find people to make sure that it happened, it's just ridiculous. Because what you're saying is, like, we'll take roads for example, or prisons for example, or whatever, you're saying people can't afford to pay for roads, or people wouldn't pay for roads if it was voluntary, because they wouldn't, you know, have that money. They'd already have that money spent somewhere else, or they wouldn't pay for the roads to be done. because, you know, roads are expensive and nobody wants to pay for it. So the answer is to add an entire level of bureaucracy, to add a whole bunch of fat cats into the middle of the process. Instead of just paying the guys that do the roads directly, we need to have an extra 30 or 40 people who make 100 plus grand a year sitting in between us and collecting all this extra money as we pay for these roads to be built. And that right there just shows the, you know, massive disconnect that people have with reality when it comes to this thing called government. And it's really sad, but it unfortunately comes down to the fact that people from school to television to society in general, they're programmed to basically think in fantasy terms whenever government comes up. You take the most rational people who can see reality so blatantly, and you throw government, the fantasy of government, into the mix, and it just completely warps the way they see the world. So whether or not, and like you brought up, you know, a lot of people will say, well, without government, who would pay for the roads? You know, realistically, though, the fact of the matter is, without government, who says we'd even still need roads? Who says that we wouldn't have hovercrafts? Who says we wouldn't have some sort of other transportation that is much more efficient, much more effective, and a lot cheaper than roads? When you get government involved, they don't have to work efficiently to get the money. They don't have to work in a manner that's best for the customer, because their customer has to pay them. If other people were involved and had to, you know, provide roads at a reasonable rate, and people were not wanting to pay for it, more than likely somebody would come up with an alternative solution. And if it was good enough, we'd be doing that by now. And if there wasn't government regulations, you know, and really what it comes down to is when we're talking about things like hovercrafts and all of that stuff, honestly, to be completely honest, I believe that human beings already have that technology. I don't think that all of us have it, but I definitely believe that there's at least, you know, 300 or 400 people out there that understand anti-gravity and could actually produce anti-gravity vehicles. But the amount of freedom that would give to us, you know, taking us off of the oil standard, taking us off of speed limits, taking us off of toll roads and all of these things that keep us under control, the powers that be, both corporate-wise and governmental-wise, they are so heavily invested in the current structure that you can argue roads all day long, but the realistic situation is, without government, it's a very real possibility that roads would be a non-issue. We wouldn't have to worry about paving roads because we might not even be using them.
Right. And for, you know, individual transportation, I've been on the electrogravitic or electromagnetic or the hovercraft type, you know, tip for a while. But here's a technology for mass transit, or how we could, you know, eliminate diesel trucks altogether. And to prove this technology's here, the next time you go to a bank, go to the drive-up window. In that tube you put the money carrier thing in, imagine that tube stretched out straight between Denver and Kansas City. And it's called forced air. Those things are forced air, but it's more like a vacuum. If you suck the air out of the tube in front of it, you can do like 15,000 miles an hour with one of those in a train setup. And they've had that technology since, who's the guy that does all the work on the deep underground military bases? Not Phil Schneider, but the legitimate researcher and author. Anyway, he's got a story in one of his books about one of the first, when New York City was putting in subways, you know, back in the 1800s, one of the guys came up with a vacuum tube type setup instead of a engine-driven rail train. And basically, yeah, you suck the air out from in front of the train, And in a vacuum setting, these things will do like 15,000 miles an hour. You know, and that technology exists at your local bank. So it's not inconceivable. And like you said, you know, they're building these tunnels anyway. I found a newspaper article, I think from the 70s, that spoke of cross-continental underground high-speed rails. And you living in Colorado, you've been to the Denver International Freemasonic Temple Airport. So you've ridden those underground things. And there's some tunnels in there that aren't for passengers or baggage. I call that thing Midway. It's probably the Midway stop between New York and L.A. in one of these high-speed things. But, you know, simple things like that, the technology's here. And like you said, if you weren't forced to pay for roads, if, you know, a farmer could put his corn on a forced air tube train, you know, in upstate New York and get it to California in 5 minutes, what do you think the shipping cost on that would be? Not a whole lot. And since it's not running on gasoline, the thing's inside of a tube, so derailing is almost impossible. You know, necessity is the mother of all invention. And maybe if we could stop paying and or collecting taxes, that would force us into, you know, and that's an example of something. I'm sure those tunnels are built. You know, there's books, websites, you know, this not like conspiracy land wacko stuff. These underground vacuum tube trains are in existence and running now. And if instead of the military-industrial complex types, you know, skirting around on them, if you could put, you know, the newest shipment of apples, you know, get those things to New Mexico in 4.5 minutes, why wouldn't we want to do that instead of paying for gas and highway and diesel surcharges and shipping and the whole bit? It would radically transform our way of thought and our way of life, because it's the scarcity versus abundance paradigm. They've got us, I think, focused on scarcity and how little we can barely do and get by on, and we're so in debt. When in actuality, I've flown and driven from coast to coast, and whether you're on the ground or up in the air, there's still a lot of open space. We got lots of room for more people and more food. I bet if you even wanted to stay in the oil paradigm, you could pick any point on this continent. And if you drill far enough, you're going to hit oil. So, yeah, it's definitely the scarcity versus abundance thing. We got plenty of room. We got plenty of food. The technology's here. You know, I think banks use those as like a little ha-ha in your face.
And, you know, one thing that I would like to add, since we're speaking on it, the reason that we haven't transitioned over to some of these other ideas. I mean, Nikola Tesla had technology that's still being suppressed today. And there's people like Brown's Fuel. If you look up Brown's Fuel, if you look up A21, there's all these fuel alternatives. There's all these transportation alternatives that are completely suppressed. And how are they suppressed? They're suppressed through the force of government. The people in control want to stay in control, so they use government to suppress anything that might damage or endanger their control grid. The same thing is true with pharmaceutical companies. We see marijuana being able to cure so many ills. We also see things like cinnamon able to bring down blood sugar, or, you know, things in your diet that can totally cure your health concerns. Alternatives to all these different healing things, and because the people in control have their fingers in the pharmaceutical companies, they use government to keep down and to prohibit anything that might offer some sort of competition or alternative to what they've got locked down. So realistically, what government is not something that protects you from being taken advantage of, not something that protects you from the criminals. It's something that gives the criminals a tool to use against you. And it's something that gives the power elite of the world a tool to keep you in control. So realistically, people want government to keep them protected, and we're fed this propaganda that our government was instituted to protect our rights. But realistically, what this government and what all government is, it's not something that has just been a phenomenon here or just recently. If you look throughout time, all government ever, the only purpose it has ever served consistently is to keep those in power, and to eliminate the possibility of anybody else achieving power. And when you look at what government, as well as private families and corporations, did to people like Nikola Tesla, and are still doing to people that come up with alternatives or things that would threaten the status quo, that's what government is for. And for people, most people, at least in this particular avenue of study, will moan and complain all day long about what government does, and they'll go out and protest for change, and they'll go out and have letter writing campaigns to senators and congressmen, and they'll get on Alex Jones's show and complain left and right about all these things that government does that is just atrocious. But then when you say, okay, if this thing is so bad, why don't we just get rid of it? They look at you like you're a blasphemer. And that's where I'm at. I'm just like, if this thing is so bad, let's just get rid of it. It's like watching somebody who complains, oh, my girlfriend cheats on me all day long, and she brought home chlamydia, and then she brought home herpes, and she doesn't do anything. She doesn't work. She just sits at home and watches Bon Bons and has sex with my best friend, and she makes me go out and work 50 hours a week and takes my whole paycheck. And you're like, dude, if she's so bad, why don't you just leave her? And they're like, well, I would be alone. Yeah, I don't want to be alone. Because I love her. Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, and their rationale is, well, you know, maybe if I complain about her enough, she'll stop cheating. Or maybe if I complain enough, she'll get the hint and go get a job, and she'll stop stealing my paycheck. No, dude, the answer is blatant. It's obvious. It's right in front of your face. You need to dump her and move on with your life. But most people are just completely incapable of coming to that very obvious conclusion.
So how about taxes then? How could society survive without taxes? Or what should people with an anarchistic bent, philosophy, what have you, start viewing the tax situation?
Well, I guess, first of all, there's so much wrong with taxation that it's almost impossible to justify it once you actually think about it. But we'll just say real quick, the first thing that people say is, without taxation, all of these things that we find valuable would not have funding. So let's just pretend that an alternative to oil-driven wheeled cars is not out there. We'll just pretend like we don't have the ability to create anti-gravity vehicles or vehicles that don't do damage to the roads or don't even need the roads. We'll pretend like we absolutely have to have the auto industry the way that it is, and we absolutely have to have roads. The first thing that I ask people is, do you mind your tax dollars going to roads? And they always say, no, I don't mind it. Okay, do you find roads valuable? Well, yeah, absolutely. Okay, does somebody have to point a gun at you in order to get you to purchase something that you find valuable? If you go to the grocery store and you find a head of lettuce and some carrots and some ranch seasoning, you find that valuable. Does somebody have to point a gun at your head as you're leaving the store? Is that necessary to have that initiation of violence in order to get you to pay for something that you find valuable? And most people say, no, I find it valuable. I'd gladly pay for it. And I ask them, why don't you think most people would have the exact same answer? Because I have asked hundreds of people that when they argue, well, without taxes, these things that we need would never get paid for. And I turn around and ask them, well, would you pay for them? Well, yeah, of course I would. And if you had the extra money, would it go to something that you find valuable? Well, yeah, of course it would. Okay, everybody that I've asked that says the exact same thing, but everybody that I asked that thinks that nobody else would say the exact same thing. So, first of all, without taxation, without the gun being pointed at people, most things would still get paid for. if we needed roads and we couldn't have some sort of alternative to them, most people would still pay for roads. Even if most people didn't, you look at companies like Walmart or Budweiser or whoever. If they needed the roads, they would gladly pay for them because they'd consider it an operating expense. Okay, in order to get our groceries or our cheap Chinese crap out into the hands of the consumers, in order to get this iPod out into the hand of the consumers, we need to have roads. If we don't come up with some sort of way to work together and make sure that trucks can get from the distribution factory or the distribution center to the warehouse to the little Radio Shack or whatever, if we can't figure out a way, we're not going to be profitable. So even if the average citizen said, well, I'm not going to pay for the roads, those companies that need them to meet their bottom line, they would step up and say, okay, we need to have some sort of way. And if not just for them, in order to get their customers to their store, they would say, okay, we need to take a little bit of this money that we would be spending on advertising, or we would be spending on giving to whatever organization or whatever. We need to take a little bit of that money and make sure that we're funding some sort of roads. If it's necessary and people are willing to do it, then other people are going to be willing to pay for it. That's just the way it is. But when you look at all the things that taxes pays for that you don't like, myself personally, I'm anti-war. I don't like war. I'm totally for self-defense. I'm totally for group self-defense. But the initiation of violence against other nations or against other people, I'm not for that. I don't believe in going over to some continent that I've never been in and killing children. I'm just not for it. I'm also not really cool with the idea of abortion. I'm not going to tell people they can't have an abortion. I'm not going to say anything like that. But I think I've known enough people that had, you know, rape babies or had babies and had to give them up for adoption that. Or, you know, one of the ladies I work with, she was raped when she was 16. She kept her kid, and she loves her daughter. Like, she still has to face the fact that the guy that gave her daughter raped her, but she absolutely loves her daughter. And I know that that's a possibility. I find all life valuable, whether it's an embryo or it's a little brown kid. Either way, to me, I find life valuable. I'm not going to use force to put my opinion on somebody else. But when you look at like the left-right paradigm, people on the right don't agree with abortion, but people on the left use the force of government to make them pay for something that they don't agree with. People on the left don't agree with war, but people on the right use the force of government to make them pay for something that they don't agree with through taxation. So we've got people using this system of taxation to force each other to pay for things that they find morally, you know, morally objectable. You don't agree with me, and you don't want to fund what I find valuable, so I'm going to have people with guns threaten you to make you pay for something that you morally do not agree with. And both sides do it to each other. And the people with the guns just sit back and collect, skim off the top left and right. And that's what it really comes down to. Whether you agree with me or not, are you willing to pay people with guns to force me to bend to your will, even though you know that I don't agree with you? And that's a majority of stuff that taxes go to pay for. Black operations, war, public education. I can't stand public education, yet people are willing to have people with guns force me to pay for that stuff. And really what it comes down to at the very end is, even if you can justify what the money is going for, like roads, or some people honestly think public education is a good thing, or state parks and keeping the parks clean, or keeping us safe from violent offenders, like having a prison that would only have violent people in it, and that's the only purpose of having this prison that's paid for with tax dollars, you still have to accept the fact that the way taxation works is it's based 100% on threats and violence. And are you willing to use threats and violence to get people to pay for something that's morally good? Are you willing to use something that's morally wrong to accomplish something that's morally good? And have you really accomplished something that's morally good if you had to use violence, guns, threats of kidnapping and imprisonment to accomplish it? Have you really accomplished something that's for the greater good?
That's an excellent question that most people hadn't even ever considered. And as far as roads go, another thing I like to bring up is, what if we paid for really thick, solid, good roads one time instead of this crap that they just, you know, paint over basically with concrete paint every single year and block off, you know, half of the roads to barely get it done? I mean, the Autobahn's there, and Germany's not exactly Southern California, so there's also, if we want to stay in our petro paradigm, ways to build roads that are quality, pay for them once and be done with it. So yeah, that's if Walmart were in charge of paying for the roads, I think they would say, all right, listen, just make them 4 feet thick, mix in all these shredded rubber tires with it so they'll shrink and expand, and let's just be done with it.
Well, I don't know. Have you been inside of Walmart lately? It doesn't seem like they apply that to their own buildings.
No, that was my magical paradigm thinking. Still inside the petrodollar. But yeah, those people that can't imagine, you know, electrogravitics or forced air tube trains, say we have to have roads. At least you could get them to admit they could make better roads and not have to pay for them all the time, year after year after year after year.
Yeah, and realistically what it comes down to is if we didn't have forced taxation and people had the right to choose what they were going to pay for, the biggest thing that government fears out of that is the fact that we would stop paying for all these fat cats to live off of our dollars, and we would stop paying for things like spying and indefinite detention and
predator drones.
Predator drones and torture and the chemtrails and the increased police state and all of these judges who get caught, you know, doing things like the Kids for Cash scandal, where they're taking money to lock innocent people in prison from these private prisons, and all of these things that people would not pay for if they had the choice. You know, if abortion clinics were only paid for by people who wanted to pay for them, and people wanted to pay for them, or you know, people who wanted to have abortions went and paid for it themselves and didn't think that they had the right to force their neighbors to pay for it, or if people who wanted war had to pay for the war themselves and couldn't force their neighbors who were against war to fund the war, we would not have war the way that we see it today. If people who didn't want to pay for chemtrails didn't pay for chemtrails, we wouldn't have chemtrails. And so in order for them to get all of these things accomplished and across, they have to have this taxation system. And in order to sell the taxation system, they have to use it as a way to divide us. They have to use all of these different talking points to get us fighting about what we should spend the stolen money on, and have people standing up on podiums talking about, well, if you vote for me, I'll spend the stolen money on this. Oh, if you vote for me, I'll spend the stolen money on this. And if you vote for me, I'll forcibly extract money from your neighbor's paycheck to buy things that you want. Oh, well, if you vote for me, I'll do the same thing to your neighbors and make sure that money goes to things that you want. They turn us against each other, and they use that as a way to justify something that's unjustifiable. I do not believe, no matter what, that I have the right to steal your money and spend it on things that I find valuable or necessary. If it's really valuable or necessary, I should be able to talk to you and be like, yo, we should probably put our money together and get this road fixed, or we should probably put our money together and do whatever. If you find it valuable and I find it valuable, it's going to get funded. But if you don't find it valuable and I do find it valuable, I don't have the right to put a gun to your head and be like, well, I'm taking 20% of your money to pay for this. But through government, they've created a way for us to do that to each other, and it justifies in our messed up view. Like I said, throw government in the mix, and everything that seems normal and seems to make sense all of a sudden goes out the window. we know it's not cool to steal from each other, even if it's to buy something that we really, really want. I really, really want the new Xbox 360 or the new flat screen TV, but I don't have the right to go to my neighbors and steal money from them. But if we throw in this thing called government and a guy in a business suit says, hey, vote for me and I'll go steal $15 every paycheck from this guy until I can pay for your flat screen TV, all of a sudden it becomes acceptable. And all the meanwhile, he's only taken 10 of that $15 to put towards the flat screen TV, and the other $5 he's pocketing every week. And if you want to sit there and live off of people's money, if you want to be a parasite, the best way to do it is to turn the people against each other, keep them fighting over things that really don't matter, keep them justifying immoral acts in order to accomplish something that they consider moral or necessary, and all the while profit off of the immorality of what you've got going on. It's a giant scam. It goes completely contrary to what we all accept as civilized human behavior. And we put this nice little label on it called government, and all of a sudden what we would see as completely uncivilized becomes civilization.
Magically.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, the bigger atrocity from those who are in prison that shouldn't be is those who are out that should be.
Yeah, even further, I mean, it doesn't stop at taxation. If you look at just laws, you look at prohibition of something. Well, I think it's immoral for you to do XYZ. It's immoral for you to ingest marijuana or drink alcohol or drive 35 instead of driving 25 on this road. I think it's immoral for you to engage in some sort of sexual affair with somebody who you're not married to, or somebody who sells their services on a street corner. I think it's immoral for you to do all these different things. So what's my solution to it? My solution to it is to build cages and get people with guns to go and initiate violence against you and throw you into one of these cages. And if you resist, to give them the power to take it so far to kill you. And so I'm saying what I think you're doing is immoral, so I'm going to pass a law and justify immoral behavior that far, far, far outweighs the immorality of what you're doing, and I'm going to allow people to do things that are absolutely immoral to you to stop you from doing the things that I find minor immoralities in. So I don't want you doing this because I think that it's not good for you to do it, so I'm going to justify people doing other things that aren't good for people to do, but as long as they call themselves government, it's okay. So I don't want you to smoke pot, so I'm going to justify people pointing guns at you, kidnapping you, holding you for ransom, even killing you if necessary. I'm going to justify all of that immoral behavior to stop one immoral act of my opinion, one thing that you're doing that's immoral. And the way that I'm going to justify all that immoral behavior is I'm going to pretend that the person doing it isn't a human being, but instead they're part of this magical thing called government. And that's really what it comes down to, whether it's taxation, whether it's laws, whether it's voting for who you want to be president or congressman. What it comes down to is I'm going to justify incredible acts of violence and threatening and kidnapping and just blatant immorality. I'm going to justify all of these immoral actions to stop a few minor immoral actions. And if it was just people doing these things, we would say, okay, it's not cool to counter immorality with more immorality. But if we paint it up and package it and sell it as government doing these things, all of a sudden it's okay. So once again, back to what I said at the very beginning, reality gets, you know, what we accept as basic civilized interaction between people, what we accept as basic laws of reality, just get completely thrown out the window as soon as you bring in this fantasy thing called the state or this fantasy thing called government.
It also emboldens these people who think that they're, you know, spraying mace in the face of nonviolent protesters on behalf of the people of fill in the blank. You know, if they had to, you know, justify their actions as, you know, oh, John Smith sprayed all those kids in the face with a chemical poison. You know, that's a whole different news story other than, you know, than you know, police officer Smith sprayed these ne'er-do-wells in the face with pepper spray. It's that that state gives them some bizarre illusion to act so aggressively also that if, you know, they had to, if your average policeman who maybe actually had a good place in his heart and wanted to keep the streets safe, if he knew he had to conduct himself on behalf of himself and not hide behind that badge, you know, I think a lot of these things wouldn't exist either, because it's they act nuts because they're not themselves. You know, these people in Afghanistan, you know, would that guy have slaughtered 17 people on the streets of South Dakota? Well, because he's in a war zone, it's okay. Because he's a part of the military, it's okay. But if he weren't, you know, acting on behalf of this fictitious state in a fictitious war, you know, a lot of these atrocities would diminish, you know, from the slave master's end of it.
Yeah, and that's testament to what I was saying. Not only does adding the illusion or adding the fantasy of government justify things in the eyes of the average person, it also turns around and justifies things in the minds of the average person who thinks that they represent this fantasy, this illusion. You take a police officer who beats down a 17-year-old kid for smarting off to him. If you take away the badge and the uniform and you just look at what's really going on, one guy doesn't like the way another guy talks to him, so he beats him within inches of his life. We would all say, dude, that was not an appropriate way to handle that situation. Well, he didn't do what I told him to. So what? He's an adult. He doesn't have to do what you told him to. But you put him in a uniform, or you tell him that he represents this invisible thing that doesn't even exist. And all of a sudden, not only does the average person say, well, that black kid should have just done what that white man told him to do because that white man was wearing a uniform. Not only does the average person say that, but the person in the blue uniform also now has a way to justify, well, it wasn't me. I was just acting on behalf of the authority. I mean, when you go into a court, and this is something I deal with all the time, it becomes blatantly obvious. It stares you right in the face. A judge will sentence you to whatever. You know, I sentence money to be forcefully taken out of your check, or I sentence you to slave labor and we're going to call it community service, or I sentence you to go to 3 years in prison. I'm going to take 3 years of your life away because we wrote something down on a piece of paper saying you couldn't do what you did. But when they say it, they don't act in their own personal responsibility type of role. They don't say, I find you guilty and I find that you need to give up 3 years of your life. The judge will say, the court finds you guilty and the court sentences you to 3 years in the penitentiary. Instead of saying, I'm going to take away 3 years of your life with my decision, they act on behalf of this thing that's invisible, or, you know, a building, this court, this building finds you guilty and this building decides that you need to go spend 3 years of your life in a cage. And so not only do we as the average individual, the taxpayer, the voter, whatever, not only do we have our sense of reality skewed by this thing called government, the representatives of government have their psyches messed with just as much, if not even more, to the point where they're not able to differentiate what's real and what's not real. And when you look at most of the atrocities that have happened throughout time, a lot of people like to blame religion, which is justifiable, but government, which is just another form of religion, in my opinion, it has been responsible for way more murder, death, and anything. So when people say, well, without government, you know, who would keep all the criminals in check? How much crime could Hitler have caused without the belief in government? How much murder could Stalin have gotten away with if he didn't have this thing called government to hide behind? How much murder could Mao or Lenin or any of these people gotten away with? How much murder could Barack Obama get away with if he wasn't hiding behind this illusion called government?
Very little, if not zero.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what it comes down to. Well, we need police in order to, you know, we need government in order to keep ourselves protected from the thief down the street. Well, the thief down the street might come to your house and steal your TV. In order to be protected from somebody stealing your TV, we need this giant system that steals trillions of dollars from everybody. That just doesn't make sense. But unfortunately, for a lot of people, it does make sense.
Can you think of anything else we missed in the anarchy mindset or the let's bring that up real quick. Volunteerism. What are some other terms if people are scared of anarchy as a word that describes this mindset?
Well, I guess the way that I do it is I don't have a problem admitting that I'm an anarchist, but a lot of people are put off by the word. So a lot of people that are anarchists will not admit that they are. Kinder, gentler words. Some people who are anarchists call themselves voluntarists or voluntarists. Some people that are anarchists call themselves libertarians. But it's basically all the same philosophy. It basically comes down to the non-aggression principle. If you believe that it's not all right to aggress against people, then you're basically an anarchist. If you take that basic concept and you apply it to organization, you say, it's not cool for me to aggress against people. It's not cool for me to use force to get my way. Therefore, if humans are going to organize, if we're going to have leaders, it's not cool for the leaders to aggress against people. It's not cool for the leaders to use force and threats of force against people. That right there, if that's what you believe, then you're an anarchist. You can call yourself a voluntarist. You can call yourself a libertarian or whatever you want to call yourself. But basically, it all comes down to the same thing, and that's the belief in the non-aggression principle. And if this is the first time you've ever heard of the non-aggression principle, I would say that that's the core of anarchist philosophy. And if you're interested in this, if this has sparked any kind of interest, go and instead of researching anarchy, go and research the non-aggression principle. And that's what really sealed it for me, was once I started understanding the non-aggression principle, that's when I really went from being a minarchist or believing that we needed a minimal amount of government or a very small, limited government, to realizing that no government at all can be justified. And leadership and organization are great and valuable things for humanity, but when the leadership or the organization is enforced at the barrel of a gun, that's when I have a problem with it. So all's government is leadership and organization enforced at the barrel of a gun. I don't think we need to get rid of everything that government does. I don't think that we need to get rid of society or organization. I don't even think we need to get rid of leadership. I just think that we need to realize that if it's not cool for us to point guns at each other, it's not cool for our leaders to point guns at us.
Absolutely. Let's plug your radio show website, anything and everything, Nathan Frazier, a.k.a. Paranoid.
Okay. My radio show is called Live Free FM. It's on every Saturday night on the Orion Talk Radio Network. You can check it out just by going to OrionTalkRadio.com. And I'm on there every Saturday night at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And also you can go to my website, livefree.fm, and I'm going to acquire livefreefm.com as soon as I get off my lazy butt and do it. So hopefully in the near future, both of those sites will go, directed to the Live Free FM website. And, we didn't really talk about it much, but I have a book that I wrote on.
Oh shoot. Yep. I forgot. I finally got around to reading it.
But what did you think about it?
Now, it you know, I had listened to you enough and delved into the topics well enough that it, I had heard it already in verbal format, but it's an excellent read, for, I would say somebody who doesn't spend a lot of time, you know, with an iPod and actually likes to read. It's not, horribly long. It's not intricate or difficult. It's the right amount of information and the right amount of pages. That yes, I would definitely recommend it for a newbie or somebody who's kind of trying to shake the Alex Jones perspective of you know, bullhorning Bilderberg as a solution instead of real world solutions. Yeah, it's well, I'll give them the title and where it can be downloaded and all that.
The title of it is As King, A Simple Guide to Autonomous Living. And you can go to my website, livefree.fm, and you can download it. I make everything available for free. Archives of my show are free. All of my music is up there for free. And the book itself is up there for free as well. I am a big believer in pay it forward. I believe if I give out my knowledge for free, if people reciprocate by throwing donations, that's cool. If not, just knowing that people actually were able to take the information and help free themselves a little bit, that's what the book is about. The book is about where you stand, where other people stand in relationship to you, where government officials stand in relationship to you, and how to stand your ground, and how I've been able to successfully stand my ground, and how multiple friends of mine, multiple acquaintances of mine have been able to do the same thing. And basically be left alone when government bureaucrats attack them. So that's what the whole point of the book is. It kind of gets into the philosophy we've been discussing tonight, but it also gets into how to use that philosophy to protect yourself when you're attacked by government officials. But one thing that I did want to I wanted to kind of end the interview on, I know that the point of your show and the point of my show as well is to bring solutions. And one thing that I would say the most effective thing, if you want to be solution-oriented, is to go back to school. Not to literally go back to school, but in your mind, go back to when you were in school. The teachers in school are very similar to what government officials are. The teachers are the people that organize the society, and they're allowed to use immoral actions that none of us are allowed to use. We're not allowed to hit each other, but back in the day with corporal punishment, the teachers could hit us. But the way school is now, we're not allowed to stand up and lead the classroom, but the teachers are. We're not allowed to speak out of turn, but the teachers are. The rules that apply to the 30 students in the class do not apply to the teacher. You know, a lot of times schools are wanting to say that teachers should be able to have guns or the police officers should have guns in schools, but the kids can't. The rules that apply to us in society do not apply to the police officers or the senators or whatever. So the most effective thing in school to fight back, or the thing that worries teachers the most in school, is the thing that also is the most effective thing to fight back in society with, or the thing that most worries the organizers or the leaders of society. And in school, it's not the class clown that is the biggest threat to the teacher. It's not the one that speaks up and bullhorns and makes a fool out of himself that's the biggest threat to the teacher, even if he's speaking the truth. It's not the troublemakers that the teachers worry about the most. It's the kids that don't care. It's the kids that the brainwashing doesn't work on. It's the kids that aren't afraid of in-school suspension or out-of-school suspension. It's the kids that aren't afraid to ditch on ditch day. It's the kids that don't buy into the propaganda, the kids that ignore the propaganda. So being the class clown or being the troublemaker, which was the approach that I took for a long time, which is the approach heavily enforced by a lot of the mouthpieces in this movement, being the one that stands up and causes all the trouble, that's not the most effective way to fight back. The ones who stand up and ignore, the ones who stand up and disacknowledge the authority, those are the ones that really scare those in control. So you can stand up and you can complain and you can sit out in front of a Bilderberg group meeting with your bullhorn and you can be the child in the classroom that causes all the trouble. You're not very effective. You're not very scary to the powers that be if that's your approach. But if you're like me, if you're one of those ones that sits there and doesn't start a bunch of trouble, but you realize that the teacher does not have authority over you. The teacher is not some sort of magical, all-knowing, mythical creature. That the school itself is not some sort of house of education. If you're one of those kids that instead of just acting up, instead of doing that, your reaction is to just simply ignore their dictates, to ignore their supposed authority, those are the people who are most effective in fighting against this. Those are the people that the government fears the most. So when it comes to anarchists, voluntarists, whatever you want to call them, those are the people that are having the most effect. People who are saying, you want to tax the crap out of us? That's cool. We're going to do the Agora. We're going to trade behind your back. We're not going to file W-4s. We're not going to report on all of our transactions. Or you want to say that we can't do this? That's okay. You can say it. I'm going to do it anyways. You're going to tell me that I have to have a license plate on the back of my car? That's okay. I'm going to go ahead and do without it. You're going to tell me that I can't put this into my body to try and cure myself of cancer? That's okay. I'm going to do it anyways. Those are the people that are the most scary. The people that sit there with the bullhorn and say, it's not fair that we can't use this cure. It's not fair that you're meeting in secret to do this. Those people are not very effective. The ones who say, yeah, it's not fair, but it doesn't even matter because what they say has no effect over me. That's the ones who are the most effective. That's the ones who are going to actually bring change. And those are the anarchists.
Absolutely. And that point first, and then back to another one. What a lot of people, almost everybody's in a different circumstance. You could be an 18-year-old bachelor, or you could be a 50-year-old father/grandfather. Income levels, a lot of us are in a slightly different boat. So how we withdraw or do the non-compliant thing, it's going to vary depending on your situation. If you're coming across information like this and you have three kids that are already in middle school, homeschooling might seem like a tough hill to climb at this point. If you're a newlywed and you're planning on, children in the near future, getting in the homeschooling mindset now would make it much easier. So it's not a one size fits all solution. But with the magic number that this year has brought us of 2012, I have postulated to those who would listen, what if this December you did something in your own circumstance that was that radical? Whether you pulled your kids out of school, tossed a mortgage, got rid of your car loan, withdrew your compliance from the tax system, whatever your particular boat is, you have until December to withdraw your support. And even if it's as simple as cutting up one credit card or building an off-the-grid eco-nature farming community, you could do something simple or something dramatic. But if enough of us did something by this December, what if we actually made the world as we know it come to an end? So that's what I say. Don't be afraid of December this year. Embrace it. Change something in your life, whether it's small or big, towards a volunteeristic society. And then, let's see if we can make this thing happen. If enough people stopped paying taxes this December, those 100,000 IRS employees might have a really difficult time coming after a couple million people. It's easy to pick apart movie stars and loudmouths one at a time, but I think they would have a real chore suing and auditing and imprisoning, 10 million peaceful protesters. Whatever your level of commitment or life circumstance is, if You know, because like I tell people, this thing isn't going to change until you do something. No politician's going to save you. No alien's going to save you. No messiah's going to save you. You know, this isn't getting better until you do something. And whatever your circumstance is, do it. And we have until December to make this thing come to an end so something new can begin. As far as the volunteering, with the, you know, the old saying, you vote with your dollars. There's people like you and Jan Irvin and myself and this collection of people who are bringing forth massive information, doing the yeoman's work on, you know, simple things, even like philosophy, just bringing a new idea to the table. If any of this has benefited anybody, and what I'm not suggesting people do, I'm going to tell people what I'm doing. If it's $5, a good chunk of your disposable income, $100, a couple $100, whether you every month give a big chunk to somebody who's changed your life without asking for that money first, do it. If you give a little bit to a lot of people, do it. There's some months I give large chunks to one person. There's some months I give little bits to lots of people. There's ways we can make a difference. If 10 million people over the course of this next year just gave $20 a month, you know, you're looking at whatever 20 million times 12 is, divided over a couple hundred people who have really made a difference in our lives. We could take this thing to the next level, lickety split. And you want to talk about, forget the secret meetings. We'll have these meetings in public. And when enough of these UFO conferences turn into free energy conferences, there's going to be some people shaking in their boots. And if the IRS is busy with 10 million people who aren't paying them, and there's instead of, like I said, this Bilderberg crap, you know, if all these people in these Occupy movements were, instead of yelling about those they hated, offering ideas of ways to change this, this thing's going to get turned around rather quickly. And we've essentially got no choice. So we can tunnel off into the world of tyranny or shake off that fear. You know, might get rough for a little while, but man, at the end of that tunnel, just think of the possibilities. So,
well, can I just add one thing real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's like you're saying, but what it really comes down to is this: instead of wanting a politician to get into office to help to you know, respect our freedom, or instead of hoping for a new law to get passed or a law to get taken off, you know, hoping that the next politician will get rid of the Patriot Act or will get rid of the NDAA or get rid of the Federal Reserve or get rid of the IRS or get rid of the auto industry's monopoly on transportation. Instead of hoping that somebody else will do that, like you said, instead of waiting for the savior to come in and fix the situation, or instead of waiting for our slave masters to say, okay, we're no longer going to treat you like slaves, the real solution is just to realize that you aren't a slave. The real solution is not to have somebody else grant you your freedom. The real solution is for you to accept and grasp and take control of your freedom. And if we want free energy, or if we want freedom in general, we need to stop waiting for permission to have free energy. We need to stop waiting for permission for the government to say, okay, it's okay for you. I mean, I live in Colorado where we have medical marijuana, and it's been great for a lot of things for a lot of people. But if people would have just said, you know, 60 to 100 years ago or whenever they first started coming across the medical benefits of marijuana, or if people in states right now who are trying to lobby for medical marijuana, if those people, instead of begging their masters, can we please smoke pot, or can we please make oils out of marijuana or whatever, instead of begging for their masters to give them permission, if they just said as a whole, you know what, you guys can write down whatever you want, doesn't matter to us, we're free, we're going to do what we want, that would be so much more effective as far as bringing across change. Like I said, instead of being the one who disrupts class and says, it's not fair that we can't smoke pot. And instead of doing that, just be the one that says, you know what, I don't care what you say. I'm going to go smoke pot anyways. And I'm not recommending people smoke pot. But that's what the ultimate solution is, to realize that instead of having a better slave master, or instead of having a slave master who grants you more of your freedoms, or instead of wanting a new slave master who's not going to treat you like such a slave, the real solution is to realize that you don't deserve to be a slave, and nobody rightfully can be your slave master. And that's what the ultimate solution is. So instead of getting on your megaphone and yelling about the slave masters, why don't you just start living like you don't have a slave master? And that's basically the whole theme of my website and my radio show and my life in general, is if you want to be free, it's very simple. All you have to do is start living free.
Livefree.fm, right?
There you go. All right, man. You have a good night, and I'll holler at you later.
All right, later.
All right, peace. Young city band, hold myself down single-handed. For murder raps, I kick my foot alone, get remanded. Bought alone, die alone. No clue to keep my crown alone. I'm deep, I sound alone. Cave inside 1,000 miles from home. I need a new thing for this black cloud to follow. Cause while it's over me, it's too dark to see tomorrow. Trying to maintain. Flip, fill the clip to the tip. Picture of my peeps, 90 ink can make my heartbeat skip. And I'm amped up. They like the champ up. Even my brains in handcuffs. Headed for Indiana, stabbing. Just it right defender. The crew is rampant, ill will style. Check the go-to smell. Plus I profile well, stash through the flock holes, burning dollars to light my stove, walk the blocks with a block. Check the games plus the games people play. I check the games plus the games people play. What's the problems of the world today?